So welcome everyone for coming on this Thanksgiving weekend. So I thought before we get into the, if there are any questions and get into the formal teaching, I just want to reflect with you a moment on Thanksgiving. You know, it's interesting, often in our communities, in the Buddhist tradition, there are these practices that are called loving-kindness practices, or in this Pali word is metta, loving-kindness. And it's a very common practice going back to the Buddha, in which we offer really all the qualities of friendship, ultimately to everyone. Kindness, friendship, support, good counsel, any help, aid. I mean, all the kind of natural feelings that we feel for our friends. And obviously, the practice is to break down all the artificial distinctions we do, we make between friend and enemy and people that we are strangers. You know, usually that's what we break the world up to. But actually, we're all in this together, and all are profoundly connected to one another, even though we don't see it or feel it. But I think if we look deeply into it, we can obviously see this great ocean of interconnection. So in thinking of Thanksgiving, I think Thanksgiving is really a response to loving-kindness. Because, again, I didn't look up the history, but I believe Thanksgiving derives from early experience of some of the original settlers in New England who either their first or second winter were basically starving and were saved from starvation by the indigenous people who were there. So even though the emphasis is on Thanksgiving, usually, you know, the pilgrims giving thanks, what about the indigenous people who looked around and they saw very close to them people who were suffering, right? And rather than be indifferent, or rather than consider them strangers, and certainly if they had forethought to how things turned out, they might have thought twice about helping them. But be that as it may, we know that these people shared their bounty. And we don't even know what their bounty was, but we know that they shared it with these strangers, right? And so therefore these strangers could survive. And certainly we would hope that the pilgrims truly were thankful that these indigenous people helped them. But I also think we need to be aware at the same time of this holiday, of this act of kindness. If there wasn't that act of kindness, that act of not holding on, that act of generosity, that act of capacity of to be present to the suffering of people near us and to realize that we have enough and can help them, if that hadn't occurred, right, there wouldn't have been Thanksgiving. And so I think it's this is very much the energy, one kind of energy that is moving through our universe, right? We know there's another kind of energy, don't we? The energy of what's mine is mine, right? And I'm here to take care of myself, and right? I'm here to hold on to it as well as I can, And, you know, I may help those few that I identify with, but I really don't care about the well-being of others. And on the other side of that is, of course, an attitude in which there is very little appreciation or thanksgiving. It's like, you know, either there is indifference to that or is, you know, a kind of sense of entitlement. You know, I deserve whatever I get. You know what I mean? In a positive way. It's all mine. I worked hard for it. And therefore, I should, you know, who do I have to give thanks to, right? It's all mine for the taking. So, you know, there's two kinds of energies in this world. The energy that holds and only is concerned oneself, and the energy that does not show gratitude or thankfulness for what comes their way, or doesn't even acknowledge it, thinks you deserve whatever you've accumulated. And then there's this other energy which gives, which is generous, and which has deep appreciation for everything that comes our way, because there's a sense, I haven't done anything. We think we do things, right? So we think we deserve the good things that come, but we don't really do very little, right? I mean, we have a body, right? But our parents gave us this body, right? And the only reason this body has survived as long as it is, has done, is through, you know, through the great generosity of others that have cared for us. Everything, you know, learning to speak and learning to read and learning to write and learning, I mean, anything we've learned has only come about what? Because others have benefited us, right? We got here tonight driving cars on roads that were built by others, right? Maintained by others. The food, all the glorious food we might have eaten at Thanksgiving, if we were fortunate to have, was picked by others, by ship by others, harvested by others, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Such a universe of loving kindness we are the recipients of. Right? And when we are open, when we are present, when we are mindful, we see that. When we look deeply, we see that. But if we live in the world of self, if we live in the world of self-centeredness, if we live in the world of me, we don't see it. Right? We don't, and so therefore we don't experience thanksgiving, we don't appreciation, nor do we naturally like those indigenous people do. Right? They looked around them, didn't they? They were in their own villages. Right? They had their own culture. Right? And yet they were willing to look over the fence, right? To see what was going on. So I think, you know, and if we kind of acknowledge that there are these two types of energy, this energy of generosity, this energy of loving kindness, this energy of caring, and the mutual immediate response of appreciation and thankfulness and gratitude, you know, this is one kind of wonderful energy, right, that moves through the world. And the other energy I talked about, the energy of selfishness, the energy of narrowness, the energy of meanness, the energy of entitlement, the energy of indifference, right? Greed, right? Self, 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 is also equally moving through the world. And to say it's moving through the world, it means it's moving through us, each of us as individuals, right? We know those types of energies, those types of awarenesses. And so I think it's, you know, I think at times like Thanksgiving is a good time to reflect on that. And I think the key thing for each of us is really to be clear which kind of energy, right, do I want to cultivate within myself, in my own life? Right? And which type of energy do I then want to bring into the world? Right? And so again, I think that Thanksgiving is a very powerful time for us to look deeply. It is more than a certain kind of food. It is more than football. It is more than just getting together with family and friends. You know, not to say that there's anything wrong with any of that. But there's profound meaning in what happened in Massachusetts. And that has a great meaning for us today. Right? Because as we know, there are so many people in our communities and in our world who, if we bother to come out of our own little narrow universe and look, right, over the fence, we can see there are many, many, many people in need who are suffering. And again, you know, we are very fortunate that early on the indigenous people here practice generosity, practice kindness. And so we can learn from them. So anyhow, that's that's just some thoughts about Thanksgiving. So before we get into the practice, the teachings today, are there any questions? We always begin, as most of you know, any questions about the practice, the practices we do here tonight, and how to bring the practice of mindfulness, of Buddha Dharma, into our life, so we can lead lives of openness and generosity and egolessness, right? And can, because it's very hard without a some kind of meditative practice to really maintain that egolessness, right? To maintain that openness. To not let the mind be always contaminated by self and egocentricity, contaminated by our own self stories, right? And to allow these wonderful natural energies that all of us have for goodness and altruism to come forward. That's why we practice, right? That's why we practice. To mine, M-I-N-E, to mine these energies within our own mind, body, mind, and then to learn how to bring them into our life, our relationships, our families, our communities, our world. That is our practice. So, but it doesn't always go easy, and there are challenges. So if anybody has any question about how to do it, how to bring it into our life, or how to meet certain types of challenges that make that seem difficult, I'm certainly I'd be happy to look at them with you. Please don't be shy. Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. Hi.
Hi. No, just with the blower on, it's just hard to hear. So again, so what Gary's question is: on the one hand, in Buddhism, there's, especially in the meditative traditions, a lot of talk on or emphasis on mindfulness, concentration, being focused, right? And then we hear about the three seals of aimlessness, signlessness, and egolessness. Or anyhow, the empty nature of these things. And Gary says, these sound like a contradiction, right? Yeah. I think there are many things that can be said about that. Those are profound subjects. But it's sort of, one way to look at it, Gary, is, let's say I'd like to I'd like to be a composer, right? I'd like to really write my own music, right? Unfortunately, I don't know how to play an instrument, and I've never studied music, right? So I may probably come to a great master, right, and say to him, I really want to be a composer and really express. He said, okay, but first you've got to practice. You've got to learn how to play. And learn how to play is you've got to learn the notes, the scales, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, once you have mastered that, right, the forms, then you can be much freer, can't you, in terms of taking it wherever you want. So we can certainly say that the aimlessness, which means it's sort of like when we walk here tonight, right? And when we sit. In a certain way, the purpose we sit with is a kind of purposeless purpose, right? And the way we walk is kind of an aiming aimlessness, we could say. Now, what does that mean? It means because even though we are sitting with certain instructions, we are in no way controlling the process, right? Whatever comes up, comes up. Right? We're not trying to control thought. We're not going to control emotions. We're not going to control sounds, right? Whatever arises, arises. But what I'm learning how to do is what? Not be swept away. Not be caught up. Until I know how to do that, it's very hard to be aimless. Right? Because I'm still driven by so much. Driven. Driven by thoughts. Driven by feelings. Driven by reactivity. So it's very easy to say, oh, I'm practicing aimlessness. When one is constantly being driven by one's own conditioning. Right? So we have to do a certain amount of deconditioning. We have to develop a certain capacity to free the mind before we can really understand and practice deeply at a deep level aimlessness. But again, we can say in a funny way, like we are walking, right? Like we walk here. And somebody could say, gee, you guys walk in a very controlled way. You know, one follows another, right? And we're all setting the pace, right? And we have somebody leading us, you know, and nobody gets out of. So it seems like, what, that's very controlled. And yet, within that, hopefully each of us is walking very freely. Right? No thought of where we're going. No thought of where we've been. Just walking. Boom. Aimless. The mind is aimless. Because we're not trying to get anywhere. So there's a lot of stuff in Buddhism that sounds very contradictory because we don't understand that it's a developmental model. Right? So people, on the one hand, there's all this stuff about vowing to become a Buddha, vowing to attain Buddhahood, vowing to be enlightened, you know, that's my intention, to be enlightened. And then you read a lot of Buddhism said, have no intention, should have no aim, be free of all that. And you go, what? Over here you're telling me to have a very focused aim, and over here you're telling me to have no aim. Right? But it's not something that's so difficult. Right? You can have both. Right? Once I know where I'm going, right, and I'm on the road, right, at that point, all I have to do is what? Drive. I don't have to be thinking every moment to where I want to get. I just follow the road. In that sense, in my mind, I'm at ease and I'm aimless and I'm just moving along. I don't have to always think, I'm going there, I got to get there. You know, that's a mind filled with aims, we could say. It's not aimless. Right? But I can be heading in a direction that's very clear to me, and yet in my mind not be filled with that kind of deliberate kind of expectation or looking forward or attachment. You know, I'm just... So it's tricky. But it's trickier more in the earlier stages of practice. Where you know, we do probably need more push. We need more intention. We need a little more to keep us, you know. Again, why? Because our minds are just so untrained and our thoughts are just going in all directions and we have so much habit energy from the past that is still just pushing us in all kinds of directions. So in a certain sense, you know, we have to kind of be much more, you know, goals and objectives, we could say. But, you know, once it really becomes internalized, right, it's much more aimless. Aimlessness really relates to an inner sense of ease and freedom. Right? So again, one could be walking along and one could appear like, again, we're walking very deliberately in a circle, following the person in front of them, right? It looks very deliberate, but yet inside the experience can be very much one of ease, right? Just putting one foot in front of the other, very relaxed, very happy, aimless, and yet going around the circle, following the person in front of me. I don't have to make a big deal about it. You know, if I'm here thinking, you know, where is this guy going? And, you know, can I trust Rick? And God knows he may lead us out somewhere there. Or I wonder if I'm doing this right, you know what I mean? And let me just get the rhythm right and make sure I put my foot down. I don't want to step on the person in front of me. I wonder what the person behind me is thinking about me. You know, there's not a lot of ease in that, is there? That's not aimless. Do you know what I'm saying? There's a lot of self still and a lot of... but again, that's just something we go through because that's still what's happening in our minds. But over time, there'll be greater ease, aimlessness. But in the beginning, there has to be a little more focus, a little more concentration, a little more deliberateness to kind of get the mind somewhat trained. Yes.
Are you saying, in the example of a car ride, just for the walk, enjoying the walk for the walk, ride for the ride, just enjoying being there?
Yeah, hopefully we do.
Aimless.
But yet, you know, walking, yet driving. So one can do both. That's what I'm saying. I think it seems like a contradiction because we, you know, so many people in our society are so deliberate and so goal-focused, you know what I'm saying, and don't enjoy it. There's not a lot of enjoyment in our... I mean, we are... Many people in our society are very accomplished and hard workers, right? But there's very little joy in their lives, very little joy in their work. And I think this wonderful thing about these teachings is that it opens us up that we can be happy and at ease... whatever we're doing, right? Washing the dishes, driving our car, walking in the parking lot, shopping, you know, I mean, it can all be done with an aimless mind, right? I mean, so you go shopping, right? You know, some people, you've seen them, they shop, they're so deliberate, so focused, they're so, you know, they're just trying to get through it, to get to some, you know, we got to get the product, got to get the thing, got to get out, got to get on to the next thing, you know? You know, just enjoy it. You walk into the store filled with people, your fellow beings, you know, the ones we've vowed to benefit and be compassionate toward. And, you know, these are the people in the store. See, we think they're just the ones we make up in our meditation. But these are the people. Here they are. Right? But we don't see them. Or they're getting in our way. Or, you know, they're all lined up ahead of me. Or... they're going too slow, or they're getting in the way of my cart, right? It's like, what happened to our practice of loving kindness? Right? So you go into Publix, and it's like that. You know, and you go around, and, you know, you're buying what? You're buying food for yourself, for your family, right? You want to pick everything, you know, with care. Every, you know, you're looking, choosing, reaching, putting in your cart, that can all be done with ease and happiness, right? And you know, you encounter people as you go through the store. I mean, it doesn't have to be work. It doesn't have to be heavy. It doesn't have to just be another thing on your today's to-do list to get past, so you can get, you know, be uptight doing the next thing. Right? Let me see how many things I can do uptight today. And then what? And then at the end of the day, you get home from running all your errands and you wonder why you feel what? Stressed. Whew, thank God I'm home. Right? Can finally relax. And you feel a sense of accomplishment because you've checked off some things. Nothing we like better than checking off things on our to-do list. That's not the practice of aimlessness. There's no ease in that. There's no end to to-do lists. As long as we'll be alive, they'll have to-do lists. Don't sweat it. Right? Don't make to-do lists the center of your life. Right? Enjoy what you're doing. And make everything you do into your practice. Right, everything we do, we practice mindfulness, we practice concentration, we practice deep looking, we practice compassion, we practice loving kindness, we practice patience, we, you know, generosity, everything. Just that's our life. And it's kind of simple. Doesn't matter where we are, what we're doing, that's our practice. Any other questions about practice? Yes.
It seems that this question of aimlessness is very central to one's practice. And of course, it seems symbolism is right from our question. It seems that symbolism is right from tantric methods to what one wants to say, let's say on one's deathbed. It seems that I remember Zen statement that said that the six aims are non-origination, no thought, no self, non-abiding, formlessness, and non-attainment. And I remember our Tantra teacher, six precepts of to know one, I remember, no thought, no reflection, no analysis, no cultivation, let it settle itself.
Mm-hmm.
That's beside the point. What I like is the analogy, for instance, of aimlessness, say a bird in flight. They don't flap the wings all the time, and yet they don't fall out of the sky. What I found helpful is discipline rising alongside reward. Can you speak to how in one's practice, discipline and reward? In the West, we want instant bliss. Can you speak how discipline, zeal for discipline, and reward can happen simultaneously?
Never easy answering your questions, but I'll do my best. Yeah. So, and again, this is, you know, what we're talking about when we talk about practice. We're talking about discipline, right? I mean, we are entering certain disciplines of cultivation. And obviously, discipline involves some renunciation. I mean, we have to say yes to some things and no to others. And it obviously involves repetition, lots of repetition. And so that capacity to be disciplined, whether we're disciplined in the practice of mindfulness or concentration or insight or loving kindness or compassion or aimlessness or whatever our practicing is necessary. On the other hand, if we are disciplining ourselves or entering into the world of disciplined activity only with the sense that at some point in the future the discipline will pay off with some big reward, we're not practicing appropriately or practically. Because in this, you know, one of the six paramitas, and the six paramitas are the six practices of the Bodhisattva path, It is called joyful effort. And this is a very important practice. And in a lot of the meditative traditions, you don't get this. You get a lot of discipline. You get a lot of effort. But you don't get joyful effort. And the Buddha taught joyful effort. He actually said it one time in talking to his monks. He said, it sounds strange. He said, we are the happy ones. Right? We who have given up all attachment, given up our things, we are the happy ones, right? And we can extend that out to say, those of us who practice this path of liberation, this practice of freedom, this practice of discipline, it's not like we're suffering now, for some future reward, right? And many of us have lived a lot of our life, our schooling, our training, our different kinds of things we go to, we kind of grin and bear it, right? For some future reward. I mean, unfortunately, many people's work is like that, right? They work all week, unhappily, for the paycheck. That's a reward. And so they maintain some discipline, but that's not a very happy life, is it? It's not a very fulfilling life. The practice of Buddhism is the practice of joyful effort, right? Which really... You go, well, how do you manufacture that? I would say a key component of joyful effort is the capacity to be happy because one is having the opportunity to make the effort. It's not just that the effort I am making, the discipline, the practices I'm doing are going to produce, right, something good for me in the future, right? But coming at it from the other way is I am grateful and happy that I have this opportunity right now to practice this way, right? That I have the good fortune in my life to have encountered certain teachings, etc., that have taught me, are teaching me how to transform my life, right? How to go into Publix, right, and be happy. How to go around and do my list of errands and be at ease and enjoy it, right? How to really learn how to love. How to really learn to be open-hearted, right? How to learn to transform and heal my body-mind, right? To reflect on that, to reflect on this, I think brings great happiness and makes one's effort. I use a lot of gardening analogies because I garden a lot. I've gardened a lot in my life and I still garden a lot in my life. You know, there are some people who have nice gardens, right? But it's work to them. It's work to them. They really don't like working in the garden, right? With the bugs, with the heat, right? With the mosquitoes, right? With the dirt, with the prickers, with the right, all the right. But they like a beautiful garden, or they like people to come to their house and think they have a good garden. So they don't enjoy gardening, but they may be good gardeners, and they may have a nice garden. I love to garden. I love everything about gardening. Right? I love it when it's easy, and I love it when it's hard, and I love it when it's clean, and I love it when it's dirty. Why? I don't think when I garden. I just do it. And I feel connected to every plant, every flower, the earth, the worms, right? It's an aimless experience. And yet, it has a name, we could say. But when you're in the garden, you're not working with an aim. You're working with every situation, every plant, as it is. Right? And then it's timeless. Right? It's a timeless experience. There's no past, there's no future, there's no product, there's no me, there's no plant, there's just, right? Just an unfolding. Just a, right? And out of that will come happiness. That is happiness. Right? That is ease. That is joy. And one can do that in everything one does. In all one's relations. In all one's work. In all one's activities. In all one's hobbies. That's what's so beautiful about this path. Right? It is a joyful path. And we are learning how to be happy within our life. And it was just pointed out, even though we follow a discipline, we're not doing it for some future reward. It has its own reward. That sounds like something our grandfathers might say or something. Discipline has its own reward or something, but I don't want to. But it's probably true. And again, it is within the context of aimlessness. Aimlessness is a very powerful, powerful practice. When we're aimless, we can let go. Right? We can let go. In a certain way, the whole practice of Buddhism is just really about letting go. Just being present, just being aware, just being open, spacious. Going nowhere, doing nothing. And yet you say, oh, but you're going somewhere, right? That's again that seeming paradox. It's really no paradox. Yeah, I have my list going into Publix. So in a certain way, there is an aim, right? But yet, the way it's being done is through the cultivation of aimlessness. Because you're inside the experience. You're not outside the experience. Many people live their life outside, as if they're watching themselves go about living a life, and they're outside it, commenting, wonder, you know, how am I doing? Right? How's he doing? Right? Is he doing a good job or a bad job? Are they liking him or not liking him? Right? Is he successful or not successful? Right? Does he look good? Does he look bad? Right? It's like we're watching our life like it's a movie that we're always critiquing. Right? Some people live that way. Outside. Like they're watching themselves. Like they're watching their life. Right? But the real way to live life, it's not the real way to live life, it's the way the life really is. It's from the inside. It's an unfolding, moment-to-moment unfolding. That's all it is. How does it unfold? It unfolds through seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, feeling, thinking. Just arising. That's our life. And when you're in that, then you're living from the inside out rather than the outside in. Is that clear? And that's a fundamental shift in how you live your life. You don't want to be an object to yourself. Right? Just another object to manipulate. Some people see everything as objects, including themselves. Right? Always to manipulate. Manipulate for what purpose? To meet the needs of ego. Needs of ego for what? For safety, for security, for recognition, for, you know, always something. Ego always wants something. So we live our life where we even see ourselves as something to manipulate in relationship to others to get something. That's not the way to live. Right? It doesn't produce happiness. That produces what? Anxiety, worry, fear, anger, resentment, sadness, jealousy, right? Et cetera, et cetera. It can't help but produce that. Because it's a life, again, where everything is calculated and manipulated to get something. Coming back to the garden. So many flowers, right? So many beautiful things. So many trees giving fruit, right? What are they asking? What are they trying to get? Maybe they're trying to get a bee to come by, and you know, maybe there's some biological necessity there, right? That's acting. But flowers just flower because why? Because they're flowers. Fruit trees just produce fruit. Why? Because they're fruit trees. Right? What a marvelous thing. Right? Everything just following its own nature. And they don't care what we think. Right? This is not really a really great eggplant. Right? I mean, does the eggplant get insulted? Does it get hurt? Does it? We laugh. It's so silly. Right? And yet, we, in our strong attachment, in our strong dependency on whatever think, or what we think, so easily hurt. So easily insulted. Right? You know, like, you know, we go into the store, you know, and now they have all the fruit and vegetables out. You know, we're picking up one, we're feeling the tomatoes, we're putting it back down. How do you think that tomato feels? Right? You know, especially if it's by the end of the day and it's still there. Right? Thousands of tomatoes have gone out the store, and this poor tomato is still. We can learn a lot from tomatoes. Right? You know, we'd be, if we were in that bin, we'd go, pick me, pick me, pick me, pick, please, pick me. Look at me first. Right? Isn't that the way we are? Why? Because our freedom, right, has been contaminated, skewed, distorted by self. Right? That tomato is a tomato. But it doesn't have a self. Right? So it can kind of go with the flow. But we have a very highly developed self. Very firm. Strong. And it cannot take being ignored. It cannot take not being liked. Cannot take getting the appraisal, the positive appraisal of others. It gets very easily hurt, disturbed, distorted, angry. And so we suffer. Now again, I'm not, please don't understand, I'm not saying that that the height of spiritual awakening is to be a tomato. But I'm saying there's something that can be learned from tomatoes, from things. Things don't have selves. Right? But yet they seem to function quite well. The birds sing and fly. They've never taken a flying lesson. And yet somehow they know how to do it. Following their nature. Any other questions? Or maybe someone disagrees with what I've said here today. Or any questions about what I've said, whether it's realizable or practical. Maybe people think this is just a bunch of Eastern psychobabble, Buddhist mumbly jumbo or something. Does anybody think that? Not practical, not realizable, not livable. Yes.
When we do have those feelings, or when I do have those feelings, anger, resentment, what have you,
Well, it's interesting what you just said.
Okay.
Right? But that's interesting. I'm not. What is your name again?
Colin.
Yes. Yeah. Again, it's interesting what you said, because we do say these things and then we always add on. But you know, we're just human, right? But we say that as if you know. It's sort of like we can say to have a body means it can get sick, right? We could say I'm a human being. Human beings get sick, right?
We have feelings.
Right. So human beings, we can also say, but also human beings have a great capacity to be physically healthy too, right? And to minimize disease. Again, we are all, because we have human bodies, we are all subject to viruses and bacterial infections, and we all can, you know, suffer from deterioration of organs over time, et cetera, right? So there are, but yet we know that by maximizing the health of our body, we can certainly, if our gene pool is at least somewhat in our favor, right, can really minimize the amount of disease entities, right? So it's hard to say what normal is. You know, what is a normal... was I talking about it here just a couple of weeks ago? Or maybe it was another sangha in answer to a question. I don't want to repeat myself if I did, but I was talking to somebody and saying in one of the groups, because it was a person who was in mental health, and I was saying... you know, in Western psychiatry, Western psychology, right, there's incredible nomenclature of pathology, right? All kinds of emotional disorders and habit disorders and personality disorders and trauma, you know, hundreds and hundreds, right? And so I said to this person, I said, well, what if you don't have any of those? What's that called? They were stumped. Because in Western psychology, there's no name for that, right? Is there? What's that called? Somebody doesn't have any of that.
Perfection.
What?
Perfection.
No. No, see, that's because that's what we think it's normal. It's normal to be sick. Right? You see what I'm saying? We have that list of 200 mental, emotional ailments, and we say, well, it's normal to have them. But Buddhism doesn't say that. It's interesting. Buddhism has a clear model of mental health, not just of mental pathology. Right? If you look, and this is going back thousands of years, if you look in the Abhidhamma, which is the whole body of the Buddhist psychological teachings, you'll see there are classifications of all kinds of negative mind states, negative emotional states, etc. But there are also equally a number of positives. And the practice is about the cultivation of the positive and no longer the cultivation of the negative. And there is a name given to a healthy person. Do you know what that name is? Well, there are various names, actually. There are about four or five or six names of all various stages of awakened people, people who have cultivated these and no longer have these negatives, like stream enterer, Pratika Buddha, like Bodhisattva, like Buddha. There are about five or six names of people, beings, who have who are free of disease, or free of most diseases. Right? So there is a model of mental health, and you can say, well, what is the optimum? To be a Buddha. What is a Buddha? A healthy human being. All pathology is no longer active in a Buddha. And all positive qualities are all spontaneous and naturally free-flowing. Right? So we have a model, right? And I'm not just making a kind of academic point here. I think it's very important that we understand that in this tradition, there is a model of health. And it's very clearly delineated what the characteristics of a healthy person are, as well as there's a discipline, a path of how to cultivate it. Right? In the same way, I think people talk about, you know, a new kind of medicine, right, in which it's not only treatment of disease and illnesses, but also teaching people how to be healthy, right? And could that be the same person, right? Could that be the same person? Could that be a physician, let's say, who not only treats pathology, but also teaches people how to be healthy, right? Because in Buddhism, that is what a teacher is, right? Not only has the capacity of helping people alleviate their suffering, but also shows them how to be healthy. That's important. And so we need to, when we say what's normal, right, is really just to say, well, as the human mind has a capacity for these mind states. But what is human is an interesting question. But go on. I realize I didn't let you get you past your second sentence.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Dis-ease.
Yeah.
What do you do to become at ease?
At ease.
What do you say? You're angry. You're frustrated. Whatever.
Yeah.
You're hurt. You're rejected. You're
right.
Ignored, you're
lovely. Yeah. Yeah.
How do you become at ease?
Yeah.
What do you do to?
Yeah.
Again,
you're asking me, this is what the path is about. This is what the practice is about. And there are many different ways of doing it depending on where you are in your practice. Okay? Yeah. So the question is, a very practical question is, yes, I hear you, but what do you do if you're sick? I realize, you know, doctor, I could be changing my lifestyle, changing my, et cetera, but right now I feel lousy. Right? What can I do right now? Right, is what you're saying. And that's important. I think acknowledgement is important. I think the first thing we can do, whether it's anger, whether it's fear, whether it's sadness, whether it's loneliness, right? Whatever. Is to stop trying to medicate our way out of it, shop our way out of it, numb ourselves way out of it, you know, all the different ways we manipulate, right? Not to feel our suffering. First noble truth of Buddhism is what? Remember the Buddha's four noble truths? First noble truth is what? Suffering. Dukkha. Okay? So that's important. I mean, I think the Buddha's noble truth is an important paradigm. So it says to Colin, step one, acknowledge your suffering. Mindfulness. I am aware, breathing in, I'm aware there's anger in me. Breathing in, I'm aware there's fear in me. Breathing in, I'm aware there's resentment, right? So in other words, I allow my mindfulness, right, to be present to what I am feeling. Right? I'm not trying to repress it, I'm not trying to deny it, right? I'm using my mindfulness, my awareness, to be present. Okay? And to fully accept that this feeling state, mind state, is present in me. Okay? That's number one. Stop running. Stop manipulating feelings. But be present to them and hold them in mindfulness. Which is, I mean, not that easy for many people, because many people don't what? Don't want to feel what they're feeling. And so they have elaborate strategies not to feel. Right? So that's for many people, that's a big step. Just to stop and to acknowledge what one is feeling. Right? I would say the second is to take care of that feeling. Because, Colin, it is arising where? Right? Whether we blame this one or that one, our exes or this is, you know, whatever blame thing we're doing, the truth is it is arising in me. I mean, that's where it is right now. Whoever I'm holding responsible for, the truth is it's only arising in one person, me. Okay? So I am aware of it. I'm going to take responsibility, and it's my job to what? To take care of it. Yeah, to take care of it. It's my anger. It's my fear. It's my loneliness. It's my, right? Okay. And I need to learn to what? To take care of it. If you're a good parent, and hopefully we are doing our best to be good parents, or maybe we had good parents, we know a good parent, right, is able to take care of their child when he or she is sad, when he or she is angry. It's not like, you know, I only take care of one emotion with my children. Otherwise, I farm them out. We laugh. It's ridiculous, right? Because we have the capacity of knowing it's my child, right? And whether they're sad or angry or happy or whatever it is, I have the capacity to what? To be with them and to soothe them and to take care of them, all right? So in the same way, whatever feelings arise within us, we need to have the capacity to be present to them and to take care of them. Okay. To calm them, to ease, to soothe, support. Okay. Now, you know, if one develops the capacity to do one and two, right, now the next step is introspection. Second noble truth. Second noble truth is what? All the Buddhist scholars here. Second noble truth is?
Cause.
All right. So I am acknowledging my suffering, right? Now I want to look deeply. What is causing my suffering? Right? And I want to look deeply into it. Why? Third noble truth.
End
the suffering. I want to be free of suffering. So the Buddha said, he didn't go from acknowledge suffering, be free of suffering. He put a step in between, didn't he? Causation. Very important. Causation. So what is causing this suffering to arise in me? And here, you know, there are various levels. In the West, Western psychology, we're more concerned with the narrative, right? Childhood issues. He said this. You know what I'm saying? That, and so that's helpful, right? One can see specifically what in this lifetime is causing this type of feeling to arise in me, right? and one could look more deeply into it to see the pattern that we maintain within ourselves based on our conditioning that causes us to always respond in this way that causes suffering. Okay? But at a deeper level, you know, in the Zen and Dzogchen tradition, the emphasis is always to go to the root, right? In other words, we can spend lifetimes trimming the leaves, right? But they grow back. So while we get some benefit from trimming the leaves, we want to, if we really want to be free, we want to uproot it. To uproot, we need to go to the source. And the source in Buddhism is self. Ignorance. Ignorance of the true nature of things. Right? We perceive ourselves as a separate self, standing apart from experience. Right? And so... you know, if you look at the dramas of your life, anybody here have drama in their life? Okay. If you look in the drama of your life, take self out of it. What happens to the drama? What happens to the drama? It goes away. Just like that. Right? There's the answer. Right? I can keep cutting the branches, which means I'll deal with it incident by incident. Right? Or I can go to the root. Because the root is what's supporting the whole plant, the whole tree. And underlying all our dramas is a self that believes in its own narrative of who it is and who it isn't and what it wants and what it needs and where it's from and where it's going and who it is and right? Identity. That's why, you know, that's why that little tomato can deal with rejection. Right? End of the day, still be there. Right? Doesn't have a self. It's not burdened with self. So that's the, you know, get the self out of the more we get the self out of the equation, the less emotionality, the less reactivity, and the freer we'll be. But that takes time. Why does that take time? Because we're totally identified with the self as being us. We're so identified with the drama of self. Right? I don't think we like it. I think in Buddhism it's called ignorance. We don't know better. We think, like you said, we think it's normal. And this is the Buddha's teaching. He said, you know, the world of gain and loss, the world of up and down, like and dislike, and, you know, and right? The world of self, you know, this is worldly life, and people think it's normal. It's normal to suffer. Right? It's normal to have emotional problems. Right? We think that's normal. It's normal to have addiction problems. We think it's normal. It's normal to have hate. It's normal to have violence. It's normal to have war, right? I mean, people believe that, don't they? It's normal. It's what human beings do. That is not... The Buddha, 2,500 years ago, said, absolutely not. There is another, whole other way to live. Right? Based on very different principles and values, but it can be done right in this life. It's like where we started tonight. Right? Who knows what would happen if the Indians, you know, looked over at the pilgrims and said, screw them, you know. Right? You know what I mean? A bunch of idiots that don't even know how to grow their own squash. You know, let them die. Right? But they didn't, did they? So... like that. But it takes time. We all have habit energy, we all have habit force. But this is the, you know, this is called the path of healing and transformation. It's not a quick fix. If you want a quick fix, get down to the bar. Right? Order a double shot and relax. Right? The problem with that is what? You still got the same problems. That's the problem. So the path of transformation and healing, like the Buddhist path, takes a little time. Because we have to develop some discipline, some skills, but it's a time-tested path. 2,500 years of experience. People in all traditions, ages, have transformed themselves through this practice. Yes.
I don't mean to beat dead horse. Will our great grandkids and their great grandkids and their great grandkids say that it was 2,500 years ago? It seems that 2000 was a millennium. I don't think it was, but it meant something. And it was them teaching these people Kala Chakra, the wheel of time. I think it was initiation of the Dalai Lama. He was all around the world. I think most people have heard of Kala Chakra. The Chinese communists. Well, they speak of a curse that says, may you live in interesting times. It seems that for that to be dealt with, we have this ultimate cosmic blessing we call a chakra. The least I can do is recognize that with the advent of the year 2000, it's no longer 2,500 years ago, it's 2,600. Even the authors who write now, they still say the same thing. You know? I'm sorry.
You're absolutely right. Time is moving on. Yeah, I'm dated. I thank you. I should update myself. It has been a 100 years has passed. You're absolutely right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Endless. Right. Okay. Hope not. I'm corrected. Yeah. No, I agree with you. Yeah. You're absolutely right. But again, as you also say, it's a timeless. Even to say 2,500 years is to make up something. But it's just good to know that. Because again, Western psychology is what, 100 years old? Not even that, right? I mean, it's you're talking about with Buddhism. I mean, a sophisticated psychological system of practice that's, you know, 2,600 years old at least. That has been tested over millenniums, has been tested all different kinds of cultures and people, historical eras. I mean, that is some scientific validity, I would think. Anyhow, it's 8:30. Thank you for listening.